Welcome to another episode of Ordinary Old Catholic Me. Promise you won't laugh. I'm taking a 4-week, quote, course, I guess you'd call it, on the art of dying from a Catholic perspective. Now, the way we're doing it is that we watch an episode of a program called The Art of Dying from Formed, and then as a group, it's about a large enough group for us as a small parish, is about 20 people, and then we discuss what we have seen and how we perceive it from both a spiritual and practical point of view. I say don't laugh because I know a few of my friends out there already think I'm a little nuts to be rather likely in ordinary conversation to mention time passing and age and reality of diminishment. And some of them, since they've known me since we were all quite young, say that I was doing that when we were all very young. I was always interested and concerned and thinking about death, even though, as I've said before, it probably came from a different direction in that I was so young. But I was someone to read about death and how death rather equalizes everything and everyone, as in the poem Thanatopsis by William Cullen Bryant, which during a phase of my life when I was not religious, or I wasn't thinking about being religious and had lapsed from Catholicism, that poem about equalizing everyone, famous and ordinary, was, I guess, a bit of a selfish comfort to me. The other reality for me, and particularly as I've gotten older, seems to be a predilection to assist people I know in the generation just ahead of me, the octo and nonagenarians. The latter was never on my agenda, particularly as my mother died when she was 48, and my father, who did live to the ripe old age of 90, has been gone 15 plus years. I figured I would not experience elder age in others so much and decline so close up until I got closer to it personally. But I was very wrong. Literally, since my father died 15 years ago, I have seemed to get close to elderly friends regularly and helped a number of them as needed. I don't say this as a matter of pride, not that I'm not prideful, but this is not a matter of pride. I have not, even in the culture that avoids confronting death or even acknowledging its inevitability, been without poignant reminders of my future, if in fact I made it that far in the number of years given to me. I'm sure there are many definitions of art. Here's the definition I found, the one and only one I latched onto today from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Something that is created with imagination and skill, and that is beautiful, or that expresses important ideas or feelings. That definition would seem to fit very nicely with our Catholic religious tradition. God, our creator, made ex nihilo, out of nothing, the universe, our world, and us in an explosion of imagination and skill. And let me add, with love that he infused with a free will that could express and does express important, beautiful ideas and feelings. He gave us a spark of his imagination and skill and love, and in our exercise of the gift of free will, the opportunity to love or not, to do, to return his love, I guess one could say we, in the expression of our free will, can create, in our turn, bad art, original sin that led to death before the coming of Christ, the ultimate in bad art. But once again, he, God, in an exercise of divine skill and imagination and love, came to us as one of us and died gruesomely, so transforming our bad art into good art again, beautiful, full of a meaning it did not before possess. He made death a door to paradise and heaven in his very presence. He bid us to learn his art, and, like the students in a Rembrandt studio of old, to create such a beautiful piece, P-I-E-C-E, and peace, P-E-A-C-E, in dying, all in his very image, with his glory shining on and through us. This dying thing, indeed, is serious, but it is also, if perceived and leaned into with the tools of our faith, our sacraments, our prayer, is ultimately triumphant art, where before it was base perversion. The process of dying, which we do from the moment we are born, is now conjoined with the process of living in a holistic way. Paradoxically, perhaps, but still an holistic way. Both are arts, potentially beautiful and imagination-filled and skillful. That's what the program we have been doing at my parish, watching and discussing in our core class, has been attempting to impress on us. What I read separately this week in yet another biography of Flannery O'Connor was her idea that the creative action of our entire lives is our preparation for death. And, as Flannery would have known and experienced, among the many tools of this art, this creative process, is the reality of suffering. As paint is to a canvas, joy and suffering are the paint of our lives, and it is suffering that Jesus and his act on the cross and resurrection reframed when he redeemed us. I either read or I heard something else that triggered these thoughts this week. Probably it was in what I was reading about Flannery O'Connor, that suffering is a vocation. I never thought of it that way. O'Connor would have known about that because at a young age, in her 20s, she developed lupus that ultimately would take her life at the age of 39. And her father had also died of it, though a bit later, at the age of 44. Now, in the 1950s and 60s, the treatments for lupus were sparse and not particularly effective, where today, just as in, say, breast cancer, which is the disease that killed my mother many years ago, much more is available to treat it and enhance life. To see suffering as a vocation, transformed into a calling rather than a curse, is truly to follow Christ and his steps closely. He came to do precisely what he did do, to suffer and to die, with those no longer being the meaningless end of our existences, to a beginning. Like most people, I've always felt that suffering was to be avoided, and if encountered despite myself and despite my hopes, was to be lamented. Now, that's, I've said before, a bit of a contradiction for a Catholic Christian, because suffering is at the center of our understanding of our faith, or it's one of the centers, or part of the center, because it's Christ on the crucifix suffering that changes everything. But reading that it's a vocation, a calling, a part of our mission in life, as you might say, was a bit enlightening to me. Seeing suffering as a vocation can be a counter in how we usually respond to everything we call suffering, from ordinary annoyances to the pain of illness or loss. It takes work. All good art takes work, and of course, an acceptance of the infusion of grace. The idea of responding to each level, overlapping as they are, of suffering with the image of vocation rather than something to be avoided, which really can't be done anyway, really spoke to me, especially in another week of things, simple suffering of my own, little things that made me testy or engendered a sense of needing to escape. And I realized that I have to start very small in taking the grace to train my responses. I'm guessing that would be true of most of us. So let's say small examples all of us experience, like the small suffering of another, disregard for our basic rights, failures of civility. In traffic, the person in his Tesla who swerves in front of you without signaling or tailgates you to force you to speed up on a local road well over the speed limit, only to find that he hits the red light at the same time you do anyway. Do you get angry? I do. Do you pound the wheel yelling an expletive? I have. Do you slow down to express your disfavor with the tailgater? Do you lean on your horn? I have to admit, that's something I've only done maybe once. Or do you think this is even a small suffering at all? A call to ordinary suffering without the emotional distress, or worse, the spiritual distress? You say, I don't think that's suffering. But it is little, but such small sufferings can build up and can lead to tragedy if you're not dying to yourself and your pride as part of the creative act through your life of dying, as we will ultimately do physically. Your little sacrifices are an exercise toward the ultimate death. And what, in the extreme, can happen if you don't accept these little sufferings? You are unprepared for the big ones. Or you could create further bad art by producing an escalation that tears you or other people apart. I just happened to hear today that in Brooklyn, New York, a couple of neighbors got into it over the fact that the neighbor upstairs, who had wood floors, was, when he walked, annoying the neighbor downstairs. This particular battle turned deathly, quite literally, in that they had a confrontation. And on the Ring camera, we see the one neighbor shoot the other in cold blood, frankly. We're kind of living in a world where it isn't unusual to feel like you're a rat in a maze, and that all these little roadblocks in your life build up within you. And if you have not practiced humility and practiced restraint and practiced dying to self and practiced the reality of death, then tragedy happens. And you're not prepared when the big stuff happens. All of this can be a tool toward our preparation. The concept, as I said, of suffering as a vocation was one thing that hit me. The other thing that hit me, and I understand that in person it is a much more profound experience, but it's pretty profound just to see it even on a video, was in this video on dying in Formed, that was a reference and some pictures of a church that's in Rome called the Church of Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception. There's a crypt in that church where, quite dramatically, there are the bones of the various monks that have passed through. They are effectively posed like a piece of art. Somewhere in that crypt, there is the statement, the words, quote, "What you are, we once were. What we are, you soon shall be." So bones and a statement like that, if that doesn't get our attention, I don't know what's going to. It's said that there are 4,000 friars in that crypt. Death is not something to fear, but it is something to be taken seriously in terms of the life that each of us leads. And what better way than to follow the great artist himself, Jesus Christ our Lord, to death and through that door? I don't recall that the video on Formed explained how this crypt came to be, so I went looking naturally on Google, and I found a bunch of articles, but one by Theo Zenu in the Smithsonian magazine was where I found a bit of the story, so I pass it on by quoting his article, which was February 8th, 2023. Quote, "The year was 1624, and the Capuchin order was booming. It was time for bigger headquarters. An eminent Capuchin, Cardinal Antonio Marcello Barberini, turned to his older brother, who just so happened to be Pope Urban VIII, for help. The Holy Father gave Barberini a plot of prime real estate in Rome on which to build a new church. He even came on the building site to bless the foundation stone. The imposing building was completed in 1631. A question arose, what to do with the remains of the clergymen buried in the old Capuchin friary? It was decided to dig them out and stash them in a chamber beneath the new church. For over a century, Capuchin friars from the world over were buried there. Then, in the middle of the 18th century, someone decided to get creative, and the crypt was made to look as it does today. Researchers don't know for sure who was responsible. According to Roman lore, the mastermind was a brilliant artist who had committed a horrible crime and found a safe haven among the Capuchins. Toiling over this macabre shrine was his way of asking God for forgiveness. However tantalizing, this story appears improbable. A more believable hypothesis has been put forward by Rinaldo Cordovani, a Capuchin friar and historian. It is likely, he writes in the museum leaflet, that the present arrangement is the work of one of the Capuchin artists who are habitually present in the friary, helped by various craftsmen, also friars. As Mr. Zenu says at the end of his article, the one thing that this crypt ultimately is, a work of art. And he says, quote, like all great works, it tells a riveting story. It's one that speaks to the essence of the human experience, which is impermanence. As the book of Genesis puts it, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return, end quote. I'd qualify that last statement is impermanence of this life, which we're traveling through, which is the result in many ways of the failure of our free will, and then the redemption of Christ, which brings us back into an order that our disorder caused. There's been a tendency in all Christianity, but also in Catholicism itself, to attempt to spare us our awareness of the deep significance of our death and the impermanence of life, and the consequences that come to us if we're not paying attention or if we are indifferent. For example, in many Ash Wednesdays in the latest several years, instead of saying, remember man that you are dust and unto dust you shall return, you've heard perhaps, turn away from sin and be faithful to the gospel. Well, there's nothing wrong with that invocation, but it could be said to dilute just how critical our learning the art of dying is. Particularly in this society, we need more examples and more training in learning about the art of dying than ever before. Among many things, my faith ought to be a school for that art, for the art of life and death. God, grant us the grace to learn the lessons of life, suffering, and death, and the explosion of joy you have always had in store for us. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Ordinary Old Catholic Me. I hope that you've enjoyed the program and it's been of some use to you. I know I've been kind of on a trend of subjects lately. I can't help it. It's partly what's going on in my life. So I kind of offer it to you for whatever it's worth. If you're enjoying the program, please tell your friends and family about it. Tell strangers about it. Thanks very much, and I'll see you next week.